You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. If you'd lived in North America thousands of years ago, as Jonathan White asks in his book, what would you know about the tides? Perhaps, he suggests, quote, a better question is, what wouldn't you know? If you were part of a clan who perhaps lived on the Pacific Northwest coast near dangerously large horizontal tides, you would have learned from your elders when low water occurred, how long it lasted, and the best places and times to gather shellfish and seaweed. Your survival, he says, would have depended on it. Knowledge of the tides is vital to our survival knowledge. And I don't think it gives anything away about Jonathan White's beautiful book, Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean, to read you its very last paragraph. The tide teaches us to live with mystery and complexity. It lives in the body of a mud shrimp, signaling when to swim and when to burrow. It lives in sandpipers, crabs, and whelks. It lives in the spirit of boars. And I don't know if Jonathan can unpack all of that in tonight's conversation with John Christensen, but his new book is a stunning achievement, a journey into science and natural history, in which we are drawn in by the author's own curiosity and sense of wonder. It's a travel adventure, a personal journey, cultural history, and provocative scientific inquiry. Peter Matheson, who wrote the book's intro, shortly before he passed away, praised White, an ardent and accomplished mariner, for his fine writing and reporting, lauding him for pursuing his elusive subject all the way from southern China to Ungava Bay on the Arctic coast of North Quebec. And I love this book for many reasons, one of them being the new phrase I learned today from it, Perigean syzygy. I said it. You should try practicing that. It's really fun. Perigean syzygy. Jonathan White is a writer, conservationist, sailor, and educator, and that covers a pretty broad range, and you'll find them all working together in beautiful harmony in Tides. His writing has appeared in many publications, and he is the former president of the Resource Institute, a Seattle-based nonprofit focusing on the culture and traditions of the Pacific Northwest. And he comes to us, and some of his family is here as well tonight. We want to welcome them from beautiful Orcas Island in the U.S. San Juans. In conversation with Jonathan tonight is John Christensen, a journalist in resident who teaches at UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. He's the founder of the Laboratory for Environmental Narrative Strategies and a senior fellow at UCLA's City Lab. And he's also the editor of Lens Magazine, which is really cool. You should check it out online. Please welcome now Jonathan White and John Christensen. Thank you.
So this book really just blew my mind. I mean, I've been around the water and the shore, and you know, I know something about the tides, how they come and go, and influence our lives, and of course, have you know read the wonderful Robinson Jeffers. A poem, and you know, always think of that famous line of the tides are in our veins, and that we feel this pull. But you grew up surfing off the Malibu Pier. You've sailed all your life. Why did you get interested in the tides late in life?
Well, I think I always had a tide chart in my back pocket because, as you said, surfing and sailing, I was always consulting the tide charts, but I had this old schooner and sailing up and down the coast, and I almost lost it in a very large Alaskan tide. And after that, I figured it was time to learn about this.
I think we have a picture of that in slide three here. Mm-hmm. Tell us the story of what happened here.
Well, we did seminars on the boat, I think, as Louise mentioned, and we were just coming in off the coast to Chichagof Island at the end of a seminar, and there was a gale prediction.
I think this is the
Crusader.
The drawing of the boat, and then the next one, slide four, is
yes.
What happened?
I think I'll wait on the next one for a minute.
Okay.
Just so I don't distract everybody.
All right. The drama.
Yeah. So we were on a seminar and coming back from the outer coast of Chichagof, and there was a prediction of a gale. So I picked a real protected anchorage, and I got up in the night at 3 o'clock in the morning, in fact, to relieve myself off the stern and noticed that something wasn't right. And indeed, we had dragged anchor in the gale all the way across the bay and were aground in the mud. And I checked the tide chart. I'd been aground many, many times. I mean, more times than I care to confess.
I'd like to admit.
Exactly. Nobody else, of course. But so I checked the tide chart, and I thought, okay, well, if the tide is low and coming up, Crusader would float, and nobody would even notice. It'd be a harmless grounding. But if the tide was high and going out, it could be disastrous. And so I went to the pilot chart and I looked at the tide chart and read it a number of times. And indeed, it was at the peak of the high of a 12-foot Alaskan tide. So I knew in the next 6 hours, not only would Crusader go all the way down, but most of the water in this bay would disappear. So we got everybody off the boat.
So I think we could bring up the next slide. Okay. Number four here.
So there she is, mid-morning. She went all the way down, and when
but just a minute. Okay. The part I like about this story, which is in the book, is when you're watching the water go out through the boat,
yeah,
carrying, among other things, these books,
yes,
that you carried along on the seminar,
yes. So we had 7 months of provisions on the boat, and everything that could absorb water and float did. So we had macaroni and fruit and books. We had 300 books on board that swelled with water and was floating with the fruit. We were swimming through
the
boat.
So you're watching this wonderful literature of the oceans.
Exactly.
Steinbeck and others float out. And
yes. Ed Ricketts, Between Pacific Tides, and Ram Dass, How Can I Help? You can't. Yeah, it was extraordinary. And the boat did finally come up.
And you pumped it out and you got out. But this is where you decided, I better learn something about how these things work.
Yeah, I like to say I got the tide out of the boat, but I didn't get it out of my head. And so I thought it was time to learn about this. And I thought, you know, like probably most people, that I'd read a book or two and spend a couple of weeks and learn everything there is to know about the tide. But the more I learned, the more fascinating and complex and poetic it became.
And in the book is this wonderful journey that took you all around the world. I mean, to try to answer, and yet still some mystery remains in it, which is the wonderful part of it. But to try to answer what you know, the great French scientist Laplace called the thorniest problem in astronomy. I mean, that it remains, that this is something that we live with, that, as Louise said, people have lived with maybe since really the beginning of Homo sapiens. And yet there is still some of this spirit and mystery to it. What's the most amazing thing that you saw in your journey around the world exploring tides?
It's hard to answer that. There are so many. I going to Mont-Saint-Michel and yeah. Seeing that tide-wrapped monastery, or going underneath.
Could we just pull that up? I mean, slide eight. This, I remember I went there as a kid too, mm-hmm. when I lived in France, and it's just one of the, it's just, this is something that sticks with you forever. I mean, when you see this, and then the next one, this is the tide's out, and now the tide's in.
Yeah, it's a 45-foot tide, which is one of the largest in the world. Not the largest, but it's one of the largest. And if you go back one slide, when the tide is out there, you can't see the ocean. Can you go back one slide? when the tide is out, you can't, it goes out so far you can't see the ocean. It's 10 miles away. And if you're attentive, you can see as the tide turns, you can see this molten silver thread on the horizon. And then it comes in, as they say, as fast as galloping horses. All
yeah,
the way
so you
across.
Can't get out of the way of it, actually, if you're
it
out.
It can be yeah. really dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there's another one that I think is also very, very striking. I mean, could you pull up slide one, which is the tidal bore, the tide coming up this river in China?
Yes. So a tide bore is when the tide comes up the river in form of a wave or a solid wall of water. And there are lots of them around the coast or around the world, but this is the largest one because it gets up to 25 feet tall.
And then the next slide. And
yeah.
So in your book, I mean, in reading this story, because you actually got down into the riverbed mm-hmm. before this thing started coming, and what it reminded me of was, you know, the running of the bulls in Pamplona, and you know, the Ernest Hemingway's famous other descriptions of that. I mean, this is the bulls coming up the river, and you put yourself in front of it and to experience that.
Yes, I went to China three times to study and write about this, and as I write in the book, I didn't go all that way to stand behind a fence. So I jumped over the fence and I went down into the river. And I calculated how fast it was coming or would come.
I know you had those numbers.
Yeah, yeah. I figured it all out. And then how long it would take me to run up the jetty to get out of its way. So I could figure out how long I could stand before it and watch it before I had to escape.
So the wonderful, I love this line where you're talking with the Chinese scientists that you met, and you meet all these really wonderful people around the world, the monks at Mont Saint-Michel, this Chinese scientist who said, you know, as a scientist, he likes to watch and understand and try to understand this thing from a distance. Mm-hmm. But poets want to get closer to see the power and beauty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah.
And I think, you know, that there's a wonderful thing about this book that the science and spirit, it's the poetry as well as the science that runs through the whole thing.
Yes, and that, you know, that subtitle grew as much out of my own desire to bring that out as the people I talked with and the research that I did, because people had lots and lots of stories about their experience with the tide, both spiritual and cultural, and narratives about getting stuck in the tide and living on the coast. And it was amazing to me just how involved and engaged people are with the tide.
So what really struck me about this, I mean, first thing that kind of blew me away was some of the science, a lot of the science, but also how long this story of human beings, of scientists, of observers trying to understand what is it that moves on this planet? I mean, this great force that is moving the oceans around, like, you know, and these incredible phenomena like Mont Saint-Michel or the tidal bore here. Very early on, people understood that it was related to the moon, of course. But what, and you know, there's this line, you know, the moon calls out and the ocean calls back. Can you describe, because I think it's a wonderful thing that I finally kind of, I was like, oh, okay, now I get it. So, you know, I get it from the descriptions in your book. How does that basically work, and how did we come to that understanding of the moon and the sun and that relationship, mm-hmm. and what, you know, how that drives the oceans?
Right. Well, one of the things that fascinated me when I got into the research for the book was that really for 99% of human history, we didn't know how the tides worked. But for sure, our ancestors had a really keen sense of the practical relationship of the sun and the moon and the tide. Like, they knew when the sun or when the moon was full or new, there was a large tide. Large meaning high, high, and low, low.
Yeah, that there's more movement when we have a full moon and a new moon, and not so much in between.
Yeah, exactly. And they were living on the coast because that's where they could get food. So inevitably, they developed a really keen practical knowledge that got passed on from generation to generation. But they didn't know how it worked. They didn't know the mechanism. And we really didn't get that until Newton and his colleagues gave us that at the end of the scientific revolution of the 17th century. So that was just a blink of an eye ago. But you can be sure, or we can be sure, again, there's not a lot of written record of it, but that those people probably wondered what was going on, you know, before they have the understanding of it, so that there was a lot of mythology around that relationship.
So I love this metaphor where if you think about the force that the moon exerts on the oceans, it's pulling. It's like a gravitational force that's pulling the oceans, the water. But at the same time, there's a centrifugal force because of the orbit that is pushing away on the other side. Mm-hmm. So the metaphor is like as if you had a water balloon on a string and you were twirling it around your head, and the tether would be pulling some of the water toward you, mm-hmm. but the centrifugal force would be sending the water, which is why we have, you know, on opposite sides of the earth, a high tide at the same time, mm-hmm. right? And as the mm-hmm. earth turns, it's why we have a low tide six 6 hours later, we have a high tide. 6 hours later, we have a low tide and then a high tide.
Yeah.
And Newton kind of worked this out, right, by simplifying it, mm-hmm. by getting rid of all the continents and everything and figuring out how the physics of work. But he was still, he hated that he still couldn't explain it. That he got how it was working, but he couldn't explain. There was still this mysterious force that was operating at a distance, you know, call it what you will, gravity. But he hated that there was still something mystical there.
Well, it was one of the problems with that transition from Aristotle's world, basically, to the modern world, which is what you're talking about right there. Because the ancient world, in fact, gravity, the word gravity was weight until Newton changed the meaning of that word. And gravity, according to Aristotle, was an inherent quality of something to return to Earth. And Kepler, a little bit later, called gravity soul. So it was the soul of the thing that made it want to go back to Earth. It was the soul
the
of
thing
the apple.
Itself, yeah.
Yeah, it was the soul of the apple that wanted it to fall.
Yeah.
But gravity is this very, like you said, it's this very mysterious, silent, invisible, weak, but pervasive force. And the scientists of the modern world, the scientific revolution, did not like that because they wanted to leave all that ancient black magic, mysterious stuff behind. They wanted to transition into something that was more mechanistic. So it's very funny that Newton, in the end, he really tried to shake that off his boot, but in the end, he put gravity at the center of his theory. And he said, I can't stand this. I don't like this, but here it is.
And it's kind of like the X factor or something, right? Mm-hmm. That you need to solve. You needed to solve the equation.
We still don't know what it is.
We still don't know what it is fully. No. So you sat at one point in this journey with Newton's death mask mm-hmm. in your hand, looking at it. If you could have one person from history who's no longer with us, that but is in your book, and one living person that you encountered on your journeys around the world, join us here in a panel discussion instead of a conversation. Who would those people be?
Well, it'd be hard to choose. I didn't like Newton when I started the book.
Why not?
Because I think just because of the stereotypical place that he holds in history of transitioning from that ancient and rich mythological world to a more mechanistic world.
And he was a bit of a jerk, right? I mean, especially, you know, his relationship with Hooke and everything, and, you know, trying to obliterate that history of the...
He was, but, you know, the more you... And maybe it's the more you study anybody, the more you see the humanity in them. And I discovered the humanity in him in this research, and I grew to really like him. I'm not saying that I'd want him here right now.
Okay, who would you?
Maybe Kepler. And Kepler. Then Newton around the corner. So we could call him in for...
But why Kepler? Because you say that in the book, too. You went looking for Kepler, but you didn't find him.
Yes.
Yeah. Why did you want to find Kepler?
Because Kepler was a hard scientist, and definitely part of the scientific revolution and moving towards a more modern view. But he also mixed in what we call the Aristotelian view, the more the mythological view. He's the one that looked at the heavens from a musical point of view.
Uh-huh.
He's the one that talked about gravity as soul. So it's pretty interesting, rich material.
And we're going to come back to that, yeah. to the music of the oceans and the tides. Okay, so now I get it. That's the Kepler connection. What about
Kepler? Let me just say this other thing. It's interesting because Kepler was a contemporary of Galileo, and Galileo completely dismissed Kepler because Kepler believed in gravity. And again, he called it soul. And Galileo said, that's ridiculous that you could have an invisible force like that. Because that was the time. In fact, Descartes was part of this too. And they all believed that there's no way there could be this invisible force. They thought that the tides, in fact, Descartes' theory about the tide was that the moon was moving through a jello-like ether. And as it moved, it compressed the ether that then pressed against the oceans. So it had to be a mechanical thing, like a billiard bar. You hit the white ball and it hits something else. That was the view they wanted to find.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I love about your book, I mean, you called Newton, who, you know, in many ways we sometimes hold up as, you know, the first of the great scientists of the scientific revolution. You call him the last magician. And this is something that is also true in the really, I think, the last generation of the historian of science is, you know, historians of science, the history of science, is realizing that there wasn't, you know, the scientific revolution was not this sort of like hard divide between spirit and science. That it was and in many ways still is, an ongoing conversation.
Absolutely. And I think one of the fascinating things I learned in this process is that, you know, lest we dismiss astrology and astrological thinking, all those scientists, Kepler, Descartes, Copernicus, even Newton, they might have worked on hard physics problems by day, but they were doing horoscopes for kings and queens by night.
And alchemy.
They were. Newton was said to poison himself with mercury because he was out cooking.
He was trying out alchemical formulations.
Yeah, absolutely, at night.
So now we have the moon because it's closer, although it's much smaller than the sun. It's much closer to us. It's exerting this force that Newton is kind of explained and figured out.
Kind of.
and we have some of Descartes, you know, crazy, you know, ethers and things. But what comes out of that is then, and can you talk about this? Because I found it really just kind of crazy fascinating. I mean, the idea of the tides as this wave moving through these systems in the ocean, so that, and it's moving very fast,
yeah,
450 miles an hour in order to be able to make these circuits around the oceans. And one of these is moving right off the coast of California, right? Is starting in Baja, sweeps up the coast all the way past the Alaska and the Aleutian Islands, around China, and Siberia and China, and then back. And it's moving at 450 miles an hour,
yeah,
like the speed,
yeah,
of a jet plane.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. So how did they come to understand the technical, these amphidromic systems?
Oh, you really want to go there, huh?
Yeah, because I think just to give us, I mean, the sense, because this is happening, like, you know, this is happening right out there,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
off, yeah, our coast.
Yeah.
And that's part of what, you know, I kind of blew my mind about, yeah, this, was understanding,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so
it's the wave.
Yes,
it's the wave.
So, it's true, absolutely true, that the wave is moving that fast, but we don't experience it that fast because it's such a long, low wave. When we're on the coast, if we stayed there long enough, we would see the crest of that wave, high tide, and then 6 hours later, we would see the trough of that wave.
Yeah.
And then 6 hours later, we would see the crest again.
Yeah.
And again, we don't see that as fast. We don't experience it as fast, but because it's so long and low. But from crest to crest, that's 12 hours, and that is a wave that's moving at the speed of a modern jet all around the world. However, you bring up these amphidromic systems, and that's another layer of this. One of the things that I wanted to learn, and I thought I would learn when I started doing this research, is I thought that I would find the beginning of the tide. I thought I would find the place that it starts. Like, there was one, right? But there isn't one. You know, it never begins and it never ends. The system is completely charged, as physicists say. So the tide, the wave that we experience here, our tide, starts out in the mid-Pacific around what they call this amphidromic system. And an amphidrome is a Greek word for a dance that happens around a child, as you name it. It's a naming ceremony.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they hold hands, and they drink, and they eat, and they sing, and they dance around this child. So it's one of the few poetic names that comes out of physics around tides. But there is
and
a
here
point.
We have it again, that, yeah, connection between the spirit, yeah, and the science. Yeah.
And there are these amphidromic dancing systems all over the world. And the tide basically circles a point of no tide. So that's as close as I got to the beginning of the tide. But at the center of those systems, there is no tide. And it wraps around, the wave wraps around that and sweeps, again, at 450 miles
an
hour.
And so, which I think you said, at some places, mid-ocean and some islands, the tides don't move that much, and, you know, maybe not at all. Can we go a little bit, can we just go a little bit deeper into this? I hope you all are as fascinated as I am by this kind of this mind-blowing science, mm-hmm, of this. So these waves, these tidal waves, are moving around the oceans, and they're moving, you know, just unimaginable amounts of water around the oceans under the influence of the moon and the sun to a certain extent, and, you know, these other things that we'll, you know, get into. But they're, as they move across the earth and the floor of the oceans and the seas, there's friction. And that friction is also doing mind-blowing things.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Well, you know, the study of tides can be easily divided into two categories. One is what's happening up there.
Yeah. So we figured
astronomy.
Out what's happening up there.
Well, kind of. So yeah. Astronomy. And then what's happening down here, which is fluid dynamics.
And it gets more complicated.
Yeah, and then fluid dynamics can be divided into two other categories. One is what's happening in the deep ocean, and then what's happening over the continental shelf and on the coastal areas.
Yeah.
So in the deep ocean, the tides are fairly simple. They're 18 inches or so everywhere. But when that tide, these waves that we're talking about, hit the continental shelf, they start to feel the bottom. And they slow down. They get faster in places. They bounce off of continents. They rub against the bottom. They reflect. They refract. They fold back on each other. And it gets infinitely complex. And you're right that you start to have this experience of friction rubbing against the bottom. And that has repercussions out into the universe, actually. Yeah.
Well, but I mean, one thing is that, this friction is actually slowing down the Earth's rotation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the rubbing of the tide against the bottom of the ocean creates this friction. It's like when we rub our hands together to create heat. Well, we know that heat goes out in the air. Well, some of the energy from the tide's friction is dissipated into the ocean itself, the water, creating warmer water, in fact.
Yeah.
But most of that energy is transferred into energy that acts as a brake on the Earth's rotation. So by a very small amount every day, the Earth is turning slower and our days are getting longer.
Well, you mentioned in the book, I mean, some studies of corals and that have found that, and I'm sorry, I don't remember how many, you know, millions of years ago, but you know, a day used to only be 21 hours long.
400 million years ago, our day was 21 hours long.
And so it's getting, and as you say, we don't notice it, but it's getting slower. The day is getting longer.
That's right.
All the time.
Yes.
And so the tides are also bending time.
That's right.
They're changing time.
Not only that, but the same phenomenon is pushing the moon away at the rate of about 10 feet in a human lifetime. So the moon was once much, much closer to the Earth than it is now. And we had 100-foot tides, and the continents were bunched together. And what we experience as an intertidal zone now, you know, might be 500 yards or whatever. At that time, the intertidal zone was all the continents. So even if we could have breathed back then, it would have been a very hostile environment.
So this is, you know, when my mind kind of explodes, you know, and you know, thinking, I mean, that on this oceanic planet, nothing is stable. Everything's changing. All the time.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that was one of the things that I got to appreciate more in this 10 years of research doing this. And I you know, it's like peeling an onion. You just keep, you know, you peel a layer and there's another thing. I sat with a tide modeler, one of the world's foremost tide modelers in Nova Scotia, the Bay of Fundy. And I asked him, I said, so can you describe an aha moment for me? And he was quiet for a little while, and he said, I don't have those moments in this field. I have only oh God moments when the tide does something I never predicted it to do.
And you can't explain it. Yeah. It's another unexplainable thing. Can we see slide 15? Is that not sure where that is.
That's the Bay of Fundy.
Yeah.
And the Bay of Fundy has the largest record tide. It shares it, actually, with a Arctic tide, but 54 feet, 6 inches.
So, I just realized we didn't get to who's the living person you would bring on stage with us, if you could, that you've met on this journey?
Probably Walter Monk, who's a foremost oceanographer. He's now 93. He works at Scripps.
At Scripps, just down the road in San Diego. Yeah, why?
Because he's brilliant and he's a lovely man and he has a lot of experience. And I talked with him a lot through this process.
And we might have actually gotten him up here.
Wow, wouldn't that have been
something? That would be. And Walter, I know I've been involved in some projects with that he's also been involved in. One was thinking about climate. Mm. And so when we think when we think about the climate change and global warming and sea level rise, This is a huge change we're seeing. But in some ways, you put this in the great grand perspective that the Earth has seen the sea rise and fall over very long periods of time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the from a geological point of view, sea level changes isn't a new phenomenon. You know, 15 million years ago, sea level was about 75 feet higher than it is today. And about 15,000 years ago, it was 450 feet lower than it is today. So, you know, it's interesting. We're taught even that as kindergartners that water seeks its level, right? It's level, but it's really not true in the ocean. I mean, it might seek its level, but it doesn't find its
level.
So
what we call sea level is actually not a constant either.
Absolutely not. I mean, the Pacific is 2 feet lower against our coast than it is against the Asian coast. And the Pacific is about a foot higher than the Atlantic, and the Atlantic slopes from the Caribbean down to the Bay of Fundy. So sea level isn't. So you begin there, and then you also have to add the fact that land is changing. You know, land is where it was covered with ice, you know, in the last glacial period. Now it's rebounding from that. So in Alaska, for example, sea level is lowering. It's dropping. And then in other places, like down on our south coast where land is actually sinking, it's exacerbating the difference, right? Because sea level is rising increasingly, of course, because of global warming, and the land is sinking. So they've got a extraordinary problem down there.
I really liked how you described that, even if we know sea level is different in different places, but you described it as the stage rising. So the stage that we're on is rising because of global warming. The oceans are expanding, and then on top of that rising stage, you have phenomena like this.
Yes.
And you visit some you know incredible places. Like if we could go to slide 13. A very famous one, of course, in Venice.
Yeah.
But others that were even really, you know, kind of, the descriptions of Venice are beautiful, and the ways in which people are coping with it and thinking of how do they live with nature. Mm-hmm. And we think that this is very, very dramatic, and it is. Is that St. Mark's Square?
San Marco Square.
But the tides in the Mediterranean are actually, you know, not as dramatic as many other places. And what I found really moving was your the time you spent with the Kunayala on the islands there. I mean, where in the Caribbean, right?
Off the coast, the east side of Panama. There's 350 islands, and in fact, I think we have a picture of that? I think we do somewhere. Maybe we don't. The Kunayala live on 350 islands on the east side of Panama, and they've been there. It's an indigenous group. They've been there for over 300 years. And it's interesting. They basically live at sea level.
Yeah.
These islands are barely above sea level. So the tide is always part of their life. They're almost living ankle deep in the tide. And they have two very different views about it. The one is that the tide is a spiritual visitor from another dimension come to check up on the village. So when the tide comes up, it's checking on everything, and if it finds that everything is okay, it recedes. And if not, it stays. Now, they also have very sober-minded scientists who tell them that if sea level rises 3 feet in the next 50 years, which it's conservatively estimated to do, they're going to lose all their island homes, and they'll have to move. And they're making plans to move. But they live with both these views simultaneously. And there are elders within the community that are convinced that sea level is a spiritual problem. And there are, of course, scientists and people who are planning their move within the next 20 years or so, so that they can still have a home.
Well, and you talk about the Maldivian government is looking for another country.
That's right. They're advertising for a company for another country to buy. Yeah. Every place has its own unique situation. In Venice, this is San Marco Square, and that floods now every 60 or 70 times a year. So they live with the tides in a similar way that the Kunayala do. And as everybody knows, Venice was founded in the 7th century, and they've been dealing with sea level rise and tides ever since it was founded.
But it's bringing unexpected things. I mean, so I was struck by, and correct me if I have this wrong, that when Hurricane Sandy hit New York, if it had been, was it 4 hours later, mm-hmm. and it had hit at the high tide instead of, the difference could have been 4 feet,
right?
Which in New York City would have been, you know, even dramatically more devastating.
Yes, that's right. Well, you know, as you were saying earlier, the sea level is the platform on which the tides operate on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, sea level isn't a tide phenomenon, really, but it influences tide. And in fact, tide, strictly speaking, is an astronomical event, you know, by the moon, the sun, the earth. But we have meteorological tides that highly affect the day-to-day tides. And that's what you're talking about, like Sandy. If these things all come together, which they can do any time, then you can have a flooding event. And that's really why we have these major flooding events. But as you mentioned, the New York tide, Sandy, was not at exactly high tide. And if it had been 4 hours later, it would have been another foot and a half higher, which would have been twice as devastating as it was.
And we get the same phenomena in Los Angeles Harbor. Is that right? I mean, that
Los Angeles Harbor has a very interesting, unusual phenomenon called harbor effect. And so there's a predictable tide, of course, but then the Los Angeles Harbor can rise and fall by 10 feet unpredictably because of a resonant response to surf beat outside the harbor, right outside the harbor mouth. Okay, take that and figure out. Yeah.
And this is also, I mean, there's some great descriptions of big wave surfing in here and mavericks and, you know, how all of these things can combine in really interesting ways to create phenomena that are either great pleasures and sport or terrifyingly dangerous. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's get to talk about how we're moving back into some of that mystery of the what did you call that, this in the harbor, the
harbor effect,
and it's the resonance or the harmonies that mm-hmm. happen that create some strange phenomena.
Kepler can help us with that. Is he still here?
Uh-huh. That's the harmony. But what I want to talk for a minute about food and energy. Mm. I mean, because there's recent work in archaeology and showing that some of the first early Homo sapiens lived along the coast and were living off of the intertidal. Mm-hmm. And that the intertidal has always provided an enormous resource, not just for human beings, but for others. I think you quote this Tlingit, this wonderful Tlingit saying that, you know, when the tide is out, the table is set.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's living in that intertidal zone is I mean, it's as rich in that intertidal zone as any tropical forest or any biodiverse loaded environment like the most in the world. It's got a huge amount of biomass in it.
And there's these wonderful descriptions in your book of the species in the Bay of Fundy that as the tide comes in and goes out, and these enormous flocks of birds that come in to feed 500,000 birds and things. I mean, this just this wonderful abundance of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's in that first chapter I talk quite a bit. In fact, the story is around these little birds that are about the size of a ping pong ball and as light, and they semi-palmated sandpipers, and they migrate from the Arctic all the way down to South America, and they make one stop, and it's at the Bay of Fundy, halfway. And they do that to feed on the little tiny mud shrimp, Corophium, that thrives in the intertidal zone at the Bay of Fundy. And this is a large, large mudflat area. And what they do is they come in, having flown for 3-4 days without food, these little birds, and they're emaciated when they land. They're just skinny. They're skin and bones. And they walk the tide line all the way out, sometimes several miles, and all the way back. And they're there for 6 or 7 days, and they're just feeding constantly. And they double their weight in that amount of time, and then they take off for another nonstop over the Caribbean to South America.
And they're feeding on
Corophium, or these little mud shrimp, the size of a rice grain.
And I mean, there's this interesting thing in the book where, so these mud shrimp also have a clock. Mm-hmm. They know when the tide is coming and going.
Yeah.
And they found this out by taking some of them and taking them to another place.
Yes. Yeah.
Where they still acted like the tide was in Bay of Fundy, unless they were there for long enough to reset their clocks, like us, sort of with jet lag or something.
Yeah. I think this is one of the mysteries still about tides that we're going to be looking at for years and years to come. There are many, many, many creatures that live in the intertidal zone and offshore that have internal clocks that are timed with the tide or the moon or both. And this little mud shrimp, again, the size of a grain of rice, has two clocks in it. It has one clock that tells it in advance when the tide's coming on a day-to-day basis. Now, mind you, remember that tide is changing always, right? It's 50 minutes later every day. So it's not like it happens at 12 o'clock every day. So it's got this clock that's somehow completely adjusted to that changing condition of the tide on a daily basis. And then it has another clock that tells them when the higher tides of the month are, because it's timed with their spawning. And that's always changing too. And they don't know where these clocks are in these animals.
Well, I was thinking of that Robinson Jeffers, the tides are in our veins. Maybe the tides are in our genes.
Or in our hearts or soul or head or somewhere.
Yeah. And here in Southern California, I have just these very, very romantic memories of when I was a kid coming out to visit my grandparents, and down at San Juan Capistrano when the Grunion were running. It sounds like you have some memories of that too. I mean, this is another, just that phenomena that's driven by some kind of clock, some kind of clock that has to do with the tides.
Yeah, the Grunion, they're a great example because they know when the highest tide of the month is, and they'll ride waves up the beach and spawn at the highest point on the beach, knowing that that's the highest point in the next several weeks, so they can lay their eggs and they'll be safe. No other water is going to come and disturb that until they hatch. And then they hatch right at the time of the next highest tide about 2 weeks later, in time for them to surface and get swept back out to sea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just love that we're surrounded by these phenomena that have such a rich science as well as spirit behind them. Do we have a picture of Ungava?
Ungava Bay. Ungava? Yes, it's let's go to 16.
So, and we want to talk about what drives these incredible tides here, but this is the story that I also loved was about the human use of the tidal zone, the intertidal resources, the food, even to your journey under the ice as the tide is falling.
Yes. So I, Ungava Bay, so on the right there is the ocean, and on the left is the landfast ice. And this is a place up in the Arctic in Nunavik region, about 1,000 miles north of Quebec in Canada. And the Inuit people live up there. There's 13 very, very small villages that rim this bay. And they have as high a tide as the Bay of Fundy. In fact, their record is exactly the same as the Bay of Fundy, 54 feet, 6 inches.
They've had arguments about who has the highest tide.
They have had a competition. Yeah. And NOAA, that was involved with that, finally just said, it's a tie. And now they're both listed in the Guinness Book of World Records. So I went up there to experience that. And I was on my way back. And a lot of these places I went to more than once because I didn't know what I was going to find. That's one of the interesting things about this, even in this electronic age. You can't find everything you want to find on the internet.
Until you go.
So sometimes you have to drop it all, pack your bags, and just go. And I did that a number of places. And this was one of them. And I was there for a week. And I was on my way back, actually. And I heard a man at a neighboring table saying that he was going underneath the ice during low tide to hunt for mussels. And, of course, I perked up, and the next opportunity I introduced myself to this man, Lucas C. Napoluk, and he invited me to come underneath the ice with him at the next opportunity. So it took 2 years and for the ice conditions to be just right. And I got a call. I was all ready to go, and I got a call, and he said, come now. So I went, and so he chops a hole only when the conditions are just right, and they're not always just right. He chops a hole in a 3-foot thick ice, and during a especially low tide, he goes down in that hole, that hollow region, dark, hollow, warm region, underneath the ice.
And you slipped through after him.
And I jumped down after him and spent some time down there with him.
Well, but also, I mean, watching the tide, because when it comes in fast.
There, right?
And
comes,
you're under there. And the other thing we're using this to set up this idea. The other thing he warned you about was like to not talk loud. Don't make any loud noises because of resonance in the ice that could cause strange or bad things to happen. And in part, this whole tidal phenomenon is also something having to do with the resonance that's created in these different parts of the world, right? That this amazing tide, it has to do with the things of, you know, Kepler and Newton and the moon and the sun, but it also has to do with harmony and music and resonance. And could you talk about that a little bit as we want to show you this wonderful video that Jonathan made about this, and why don't you introduce it?
So one of the challenges that I had in all this research was that I had to hold a lot of different ideas about the tide in my head at once. Because it's not a perfectly clean, linear kind of process. Because the tide is one thing, but it's also something else. It's kind of like the Kunayala living with the spirit and the science at one time. So you have to do that a little bit with the tide. So one of the things that the tide is vibration. I mean, really, when you stir the pot long enough, it's really about vibration. And physicists tell us that the world really is, at bottom, about vibration. Well, so the tide's no exception to that. And more specifically about resonance. So resonance is when something vibrates in response to something else, like a bell that rings when you hit it. Or on Crusader, when I hit a certain RPM with the engine, all the windows started to rattle. They resonated with the beat of that particular beat of the engine. If I sped up or slowed down, they'd stop. And of course, we know that resonance when we sing in the shower. And I'm sure you sing in the shower, right? So you, when you hit a certain note in the shower and the stall resonates with your voice, let's say it's a C, all of a sudden that the note is rich and full and it's exaggerated and you feel like a genius. You feel like you miss your calling or something. But actually what's going on there is it's the shower stall is resonating with that particular note. Now, if you blow that analogy up as large as the solar system, that is really what's happening with the tides. So the notes, the singing, are any of the different relationships of the Earth, Sun, and the Moon. And we know they're always moving, and there's always a gravitational pull, but you can freeze those relationships. Like typically, you could freeze a full moon or a new moon, right? And you could call that moment a beat or a note. Well, the shower stalls in that analogy are the ocean basins of the world. And each one has a different tendency to vibrate. It hears a particular note and not maybe others.
And it is like, then it is like, it, you know, the moon calling out and the ocean responding. But they're sometimes also calling to each other.
That's right.
What questions do you have for Jonathan? I think we have some microphones coming around.
Oh, yeah. Hi, I was working in South Bend, and I got a chance to go up to Michigan, Buffalo. And, you know, they surf the lakes up there. But we were waiting for the wind, you know, the cold. But how do you, does those concepts still apply to the lakes area, Michigan? You know, the gravity. And
tides.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you say that the tides even affect our bodies.
Yeah, sure. There's a tide in your cup of coffee if you wanted to try and figure it out. But, I mean, I don't know that you could discern that difference. But, yes, there are tides in the lakes. And the wind, though, can play havoc with it. And can a strong wind with a tide can bring it in sooner and higher. And vice versa. If the wind is going against a tide, it can hold it back.
So it's still happening out there.
Yes, definitely.
You were saying about how birds and animals have a clock and tides go together. I was wondering if they have a name for the birds and animals undersea. Do they put names on tides that they go right? Loggerhead turtle. That means that they have a clock, like you were talking, how when they lay their eggs, go certain areas and come back. Have you worked with them to figure out names for the tides, maybe?
So there are some names of when those extremely high tides and the lower tides and the seasonality of the tides. I mean, some, like the spring tide, which is not a spring phenomena, but is
right. So you're absolutely right that I think that the I don't know that we know yet to what extent the turtles, for example, have these kinds of tide clocks, but they do time their laying of the eggs with the tides. And there are the exceptional high tides that happen during any monthly cycle are spring tides. They're, and it's again, it's not anything to do with the season. It's a Saxton word meaning to leap ahead. And then neap tides are the other smaller tides. And then every year you have you can have much larger tide events called Phrygian syzygies. Like I think Louise mentioned that, right? Right. Okay, so that
Phrygian
syzygy. Yeah. And but well, can I describe what that is?
Briefly? Yeah.
But, so we all know now that the moon doesn't circle the Earth in a perfect circle, right? Sometimes it's closer to the Earth, and sometimes it's further away. Well, when it's closer to the Earth, it's in perigee, and when it's further away, it's in epigee. So when and syzygy means lined up. It's a Greek word meaning yoked together. So when the moon, sun, and Earth are all aligned, and we see either new moon or full moon, that's called syzygy. So when you have, when the moon is in perigee, closest to the Earth, and exerting the most amount of gravitational pull in the oceans, and it's full or new, that's a Phrygian syzygy.
And that's when we get these things that I've seen, you know, called king tides. This very high tides that we sometimes see that people think are also foretelling of the tides that are going to become more common.
Exactly.
With global warming. Yeah. I mean, that we will see these kinds of tides more often.
And there are actually degrees of Phrygian syzygy because it's actually a moment in time, right? You can distill it to a second when the moon is full and when the moon is in perigee. And if those are lined up by 2 days apart, let's say, you still have a Phrygian syzygy, but it's not as large, or the tides are not as large, as if they line up exactly. And they line up exactly only 10, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, my question is about the people who live on those 350 islands east of Panama, and you say they see the loss of their islands as a spiritual problem. Can you elaborate on how they think about all that?
Well, I think one of the interesting things I found in this book, and it's a thread all the way through, that that the Kuniyala people are more talented at work at living with paradox, I think, than we are in our culture. So they live very fluidly with both these views, and it doesn't seem to be a conflict. So on one hand, they can believe that it's a spiritual visitor, but they can also believe and work with the science that tells them that this is sea level rise, and it is rising, and they do need to move.
But do they think it's somebody who's some spirit who's punishing them, or do they think of it in some different way, or how does that?
Well, they think of the tide as a spiritual visitor from another dimension, checking up on the village. So the traditional view then with sea level rise would be that this is a spiritual problem, and that the answer is to work on the equilibrium of the village, of the community, that there's some malaise that needs to be rectified or fixed.
There's some beautiful descriptions in the book when the tide comes in to check on the village, and when it withdraws, it's a sign that everything is okay. So when it doesn't, if it's not withdrawing, that's a sign of a problem or out of balance. And in a sense, it is a sign of our larger problem and being out of balance.
I think so.
I didn't want to lose track, particularly because you're a Malibu boy. You talked about the LA Harbor. I have a client down there trying to transform the wharf into a new center. But that harbor effect that you talk about, A, does it spill over to next door to the Long Beach Harbor? B, are there other unusual effects of the tides here in the South Bay and up to Malibu and down the coast that you've found in your time down here and that I would think you'd be particularly interested in?
Not specifically. I did visit LA Harbor and did quite a bit of research about it because it's such an unusual, they still don't know really what is going on, but can you imagine a 10-foot rise in a matter of a couple hours, unpredictably. They've had all kinds of problems with boats in there. And it's a to circle back to that, it's a resonant effect with surf beat outside the harbor entrance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a beat. It's a pulse, right? Like a tuba playing.
And so we have time for one more question, and then Jonathan is going to be outside to sign books.
Okay. It's right over here.
Hey, thanks for coming and speaking to us tonight. When you were showing the video, I was watching the salt bounce around in the cans, and I thought this, you tell me I'm insane, but have you considered the possibility of setting that same thing up, playing a piece of music, Brandenburg Concerto, CJM Blues, could be anything, and then capturing that salt in some way, maybe as an image or something, as a piece of art named for the music that you played that created that pattern?
Why don't we work together on that? I like it, yeah.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for coming out tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
I hope you go away with some understanding of the beautiful science and some new vocabulary for describing the world around us, including Perigean syzygy, as well as this great sense of the spirit and art and music of the oceans. Thanks.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.